This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The farm at Penny Lane is indeed a farm with vegetables and livestock, but it's also a place where adults with mental illness or developmental disabilities can receive a kind of therapy. This 40-acre plot of land in Pittsburgh was started by Tava Mahadevan. Tava is also the director of operations for the Center for Excellence at the Community Mental Health, Center for Excellence in Community Mental Health at UNC School of Medicine, and he's the executive director of the nonprofit XDS that provides health and wellness services to people with mental illness. Tava Mahadevan, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about, you know, we want to talk about the farm, certainly, but I do want to get some of your background and your earliest days in Sri Lanka, where you started out. Tell us about your growing up in Sri Lanka.
So I was born in Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka is a tiny island south of India. It's in the Indian Ocean. Obviously, I was born and was brought up there. When I was 16, it was, 1983. I still remember the date. 1983, July the 25th is still etched in my brains. We had a large ethnic conflict that was flaring up, and it just completely spilled over into the city of Colombo, where I was living. To make a long story short, a house was firebombed by a mob. We were lucky to be alive. We have to escape by jumping from a second-story balcony of our house. We ended up in different places, but I managed to get to, me and my older brother managed to leave and go to India as refugees. So that was my little...
Your parents, I understand, were interested in issues of social justice. Is that right?
They were very interested in it from the beginning. While we were growing up, they were a big influence in my life. They were involved in charity work in Sri Lanka, just sort of day-to-day things. They really taught us well when we were growing up. So that had a strong influence in my upbringing up there.
And then when you got to India, you ended up in what was essentially an orphanage, right?
That's right. It was called the Ramakrishna Missions. It's a religious order in India, Sri Lanka, and in many parts of the world. One of the Ramakrishna Mission chapters in South India, close to Madras, now it's called Chennai, took us in, and we lived there for a little while with a whole bunch of orphans from India.
And what was that? And you also were, I guess, visited prisons as well.
Yeah. When I was in Sri Lanka, we had an opportunity to work with some of the prison population. These are people who were set up for pre-release. So I had an opportunity to be able to go with another social organization to work with some of the inmates who are going to be coming out into the general population. So was a good experience.
What you're doing, a kind of social work at this time. You're volunteering to help people reorient get their lives started after a stay in prison.
That's right, yeah.
So what were you expecting at this time? Your life is totally disrupted. You're in the house when it's firebombed. You end up in an orphanage in India. When we say orphanage, did your parents survive or did you become separated?
Yeah, we got separated, but eventually we all managed to meet in India after 6 months. So I think it obviously had a profound impact in all of us. One of the things, obviously, I wanted to do at that point was just the fact of me being alive and have gone through this huge ordeal, really wanted to do something. That was always in my mind, to be able to go out and do something good for the rest of the world.
Well, you know, that's not so intuitive. I mean, after having been through an awful experience like that in an ethnic conflict, there are a lot of other ways to respond to being in your position, and they're not always with altruism and benevolence.
That's right. Unfortunately, I've seen several of my friends have got into some serious trouble and are probably not even here today. But for some reason, I think my path, I guess I was able to choose a different path.
So now how did you get then to the United States?
Yeah, so I'm actually a tabla player. A tabla is a percussion Indian instrument. I was chosen as one of the two students from Madras Christian College, where I went to college, to come to Davidson College, North Carolina, on an exchange program.
You got to Davidson on an exchange program?
Yeah. So Davidson had an exchange program with Madras Christian College. And I was one of the people was lucky to be chosen to come to Davidson.
Was there anything about your tabla playing that that attracted you to or attracted that got their attention?
I don't know. It's very possible. We have kind of impressed our Davidson students and faculty when they were in India.
What was that? How much did you know about the United States? And was that any part of your plan as a young man, particularly as you started to sort of reconstruct your life in India, of getting an education, coming to the United States? Was that part of the plan at any point?
Right. Actually, to be honest with you, looking back now, didn't know much about it, except certainly knew Ronald Reagan at that point because mm-hmm. he was all over the news. But other than that, didn't know much about the United States or even North Carolina, for that matter.
And before you left India, you were doing other volunteer projects as well. It wasn't just the prison project.
That's right. So part of being at the university, I was able to work with a few other social organizations that went out to villages, working with people with both physical and mental disabilities, helping people to cope with what they have as far as their condition, but also looking at setting up small micro enterprises, small businesses. We call them cottage industries. So that was kind of an eye-opening thing for me to see when people have nothing. It's amazing how creative some of those folks get.
So. And you were working with refugees as well?
Yeah, there were refugees too, again from Sri Lanka and also from other places like Tibet and other places. We had people living in South India. So it was an amazing experience for me.
Interesting to see that you focused on micro enterprises as well, because when we think about refugee populations, people living in poverty, our first thought runs to NGOs and nonprofits, you know, sort of charity work. But right away, you're seeing the possibility for micro enterprises, which suggests you see that all these folks have a lot to offer and plenty of energy.
Very much so. I think it's just amazing how when people are able to be self-sufficient and be able to show off their talent and use their talent, it's amazing what that does to someone, to their self-esteem, and also sort of take charge of your life is so much better than waiting on somebody else to give you a handout.
And yet that's required. Somebody has to open their door when you lose a house and you're being chased out of your country. Somebody has to say, you can come here free. Right? And somebody has to give you something to get started, but then to recognize that you have the energy to do something and provide the means. I mean, if you're right, and you are, that people are quite willing and capable of doing good work and provide for themselves, but they find themselves in a refugee camp in another country. You can't just, you know, go out and get your law degree and hang a shingle, right?
That's right. It's very hard. So making that connection somehow, making that bridge, I think it's going to be really critical. Essentially, it's giving people the opportunity. It is so important because you would see majority of the people would grab onto it if you are given the opportunity.
Were you thinking kind of big picture as you're doing this work, and again, a young man, and before you went to college, you're still in India now, thinking about the big picture, how do you construct the architecture, the infrastructure to make this work? Because I can imagine you can be so absorbed in just the day-to-day getting by that you wouldn't have time to think big picture.
Yeah. It's just having this as a way of a dream has been extremely helpful to cope with the day-to-day concerns and problems that we were facing. So to me, this was like a dream. To take some time off and start to dream about things or the big pieces has always kept me away from just sort of getting caught up on the day-to-day miseries.
So what were you doing then when you got to Davidson? You declared a major, and were you ready to get into this work right away?
No. Davidson was an amazing experience. Everything was new, including using the toilet was new. Coke machines, just getting used to everything here seems so different. However, I was so pleased to be here. It was a very welcoming community. Davidson is a very nice college. People were very open. And we also had a lot of international students at Davidson, even though it's a small college. So that gave an opportunity to really get to know here, Davidson, and also get to know North Carolina, but also get to know them in a setting which is very supportive and sort of nurturing, and also opening the door to many more possibilities at Davidson.
Did you have any other family in the U.S. or in North Carolina?
I didn't, and I don't now.
So what was your major there, and then where'd you go from there?
Right. So I it was an international certificate program. I had applied for my graduate school from there to UNC Chapel Hill, and I got admitted, so I didn't have to spend another extra year at Davidson to declare a major. So I was able to leave Davidson after a year, go to Boone, North Carolina, and worked there before I got to UNC Chapel Hill.
What were you doing in Boone?
So, interestingly, I got a job working in a group home, actually two group homes in Boone and in North Wilkesboro, which was a very eye-opening experience, again, working with people with multiple disabilities. These are people with mental illness and also developmental disabilities in a group home setting. I was in one home, I was a relief group home manager, which really gave me the opportunity to live, spend the night, help people learn to cook, clean, take people out, sort of live with seven other adults with disabilities was a profound life-changing experience.
Was it your goal to work with people with mental disabilities at that point?
That group's kind of drew me in for some reason. I always felt like I felt home there, so I love working with that group.
Tava Mahadevan is the founder of The Farm at Penny Lane. He is also the director of operations at the Center for Excellence in Community Mental Health at UNC School of Medicine and executive director of the nonprofit XDS. We'll talk more with Tava on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking with Tava Mahadevan, who is the founder of the farm at Penny Lane. So we're talking about going up into the mountains and working at a group home where patients were being transitioned from Broughton Hospital. And tell us about that, because that is part of the issue that you're dealing with.
So this was about 20, 25 years ago. People were moving out of state hospitals. These are folks with multiple disabilities, lived sometimes 10, 15 years at state hospitals, slowly being transitioned into the community as part of the deinstitutionalization plan. The folks that I was working with came from Broughton Hospital, which is one of the five state psychiatric hospitals in the western part of the state. So it's very new when they move in.
And of course, the theory was that treatment and therapy could be better in a more home-like setting, so we can get people out of the hospitals. It would cost less and be more therapeutic, better outcomes. The problem in many cases was that the money didn't follow the patients, follow-up was sketchy, and a lot of people got lost in the process.
That's exactly right. And it's not just the money didn't follow the patients or people, but also there wasn't enough infrastructure set up to serve people, especially these are long-term illnesses and which you need long-term solutions. And putting little Band-Aids has not helped at all. So unfortunately, we ended up losing a lot of people to either the legal system. They ended up in prison. They ended up homeless. It's very unfortunate. But I think the issue is mostly around not being able to set up appropriate community-based services.
That could really follow up on people. Obviously, if you prescribe medicines and say, take this three times a day, go home, and you forget, now we've lost you if we don't follow up. That's part of the problem. For the people who are there, the transition, as you suggest, very difficult. I've been in an institutional setting for many, many years. Suddenly, I have a little more independence. Take us through a day and some of the challenges for patients who had to make that adjustment.
Right. So somebody comes out, they finally have a home that they can call, or maybe they have a bedroom. Simple things like, how am I going to make this meal today? Who's going to help me? Am I going to plan my week? Who's going to plan my day? Who's going to help me go to the bank? How am I going to get to the bank? How am I just going to live in this new house? Who are my neighbors? Is somebody going to look at me and say something differently? So lots of challenges that we sort of take it for granted.
What were you learning through this whole process?
Now, this was kind of interesting to me, too, because I had some similar issues when I came here. So it was kind of interesting to see some of the same type of challenges that people were facing. So in some ways, I could really identify myself and start to really listen to people and learn their anxieties and be able to sort of intuitively trying to help them plan ahead with certain things. So planning ahead has always been something that I always wanted to do and was doing, and this was a perfect place to try some of those things out.
And of course, when you're working with people who have deficits, that may be one of them, the ability to plan. And so having the empathy and the will is one thing, but then there are strategies. You have I think, an example of one time when a patient just sat down in the middle of the street and wasn't going to go anywhere.
That's right. Unfortunately, one day after coming out of a bank trip and the client didn't get the full amount of money that they were supposed to get and was very angry, and one of the ways she showed her anger was halfway down the street, she decided to get out of the van and just lie down on the middle of the street and not get up.
What'd you do?
Had to stop the van, obviously have to calm the other six people who were in the van, and certainly stop traffic, speak with her. Obviously, somebody had already called the police department. We had two policemen show up, sort of working through the details and working with her, and we finally managed to calm her down and get her back into the van with us and take her home.
Through all of this, you must be noticing what is and is not available for people who need help, right?
Very much so, yeah. So one of the things that I was able to learn was, where are the gaps? What is missing for people? Certainly we had physicians who are able to prescribe medicines. We had places where you can go for maybe an office-based therapy session. However, there are so many other gaps. You may get a prescription, but who's going to help you pay the copay? Even if it's $3, you're going to need that when you go to the pharmacy. So you're sort of learning those gaps as far as what is really missing in the system, which without those, people will fall apart.
And also in the group homes themselves, obviously you need a lot of rules and a lot of structure. But again, we're working with a population that may not always be able to adapt to those challenges. What was that like?
Right. So in general, I mean, group homes weren't that bad of a choice in terms of there was some level of structure. But in terms of if somebody wanted to do something differently, say they wanted to get up at 10 o'clock in the morning because they didn't feel good about getting up early that morning, that was hard to do. Things were kind of regimented in some ways, so you had to follow certain schedules. It wasn't individualized, so that was obviously an issue.
And what do you do in that case? Because again, some people need a lot of structure, and if somebody else breaks the rule, that can be difficult for them and set them off as well, right?
That's exactly right, which really made us start to think about maybe some of those folks who are a little bit more independent may be able to live on their own. That is something that we need to explore more. Obviously, that came with a lot of other challenges, but immediately that started to sort of spark our brains to think this may be another way to look at providing services in the community and finding homes for people to be able to live on their own.
Well, so from those group homes, then you ended up at working at Central Regional Hospital, right? Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So I was able to get to my graduate program here at UNC Chapel Hill. And part of the program, I was able to do an internship at the John Umstead Hospital. Now it's called Central Regional Hospital.
And what did you learn there? What was your work like there?
That was probably one of the most profound experiences that I've ever had. It's sort of the last place for people to go to when you are extremely symptomatic, you are not able to live in the community, the law is behind you, you are just have no other place to go. However, it's also an amazing learning opportunity. You really learn about people when they are really completely down in their lives.
And these are people who are dangerous to themselves. They're dangerous to, or at least deemed dangerous to society.
That's correct.
So this is a risky place to be.
It is. And we had different types of settings within the hospital setting. We had locked wards and we had open wards. So it was very useful to sort of be in there. And there was also a very dedicated group of staff people who worked there to be able to really get to know people. And these are people who stayed there long term. So you really got to know them well.
There's an important lawsuit that we should know about, Thomas S., the Thomas S. lawsuit in the 1980s, and how that changed mental health management in North Carolina. Tell us about that.
So the Thomas S. lawsuit was a lawsuit that started sometime in the early 80s. People with developmental disabilities and mental health issues were housed at state psychiatric hospitals. Essentially, the lawsuit said that these people were being just warehoused and were not getting adequate treatment. So based on the lawsuit, the state was able to put in extra resources to bring people out of state institutions into a community-based setting across North Carolina.
And this is not the deinstitutionalization that had gone on earlier. This is a particular set of charges that said that the people who remain are still not being treated quite right.
That's correct. And it's a specialized group. These are people with dual disorders, people with developmental disabilities, like mental retardation and a serious mental illness.
And so what was the remedy? What was going on? What was not right in the hospitals? And how did a group home setting or a different setting change that?
Right. So essentially what it said, the lawsuit said, was that there was not the expertise to work with people with dual disorders at the hospital. These are people who could, with the proper supports, can live in their communities, and the funding was allocated to provide those infrastructures to the community so that people can return back to where they actually came from.
And when you talk about that infrastructure, what does that mean? What do we now put in place?
Right. So the infrastructure here is essentially funding for supportive housing, funding for supported employment, funding for meaningful life in the community. So essentially it's providing services, wraparound services in the community for people to be able to live.
Well, what would be, what's the importance of the community? It seems to me like you need clinicians, doctors and other professionals who understand what they're dealing with, the medicines and the money to pay for those medicines, a place to live, and hopefully some jobs. What else is it about the community that would be important?
So in general, sort of looking at not just having doctors and medicine, but also looking at how can you use things like that more flexibly. So one of the things that we learned very quickly was there were good practices. One of them is called Assertive Community Treatment Team, that we built the first team in the Triangle area to be able to serve people in the community as a wraparound team that is available 24/7, 365 days based on need.
So what were the things, what makes good case management and what makes good regional control over a system like this? What did you find that you liked?
Right. I think the part that we liked was, number one, was the people who were working in the system who were able and willing to embrace some newer ideas. Two, we were also looking at flexible services. Going back to the Assertive Community Treatment Team, it's a team that is available pretty much any time based on need, as opposed to a fixed point of appointment time.
So tell us now about your nonprofit, XDS, and how that's structured.
Right. So XDS was started in 2004 as a kind of an answer to the mental health reform law that was passed in 2001, where the law essentially said that mental health centers could not continue providing direct services. Services had to be divested out to private providers. We were a little worried about that, rightfully so, now that we think back. In 2004, we decided that because we were providing services as part of the local mental health center, that we would want to continue doing the same thing and did not want to be sold out to a for-profit entity. And a few committed people that I was working with decided that we would start a nonprofit called Cross Disability Services, or XDS.
Let me ask you first about your worries. What was it that you were worried about?
One of our worries from what we have seen in the past was there could be an entity coming in just looking at dollars and cents, and if they don't match, things can fall apart where they just leave everything and go, and our clients are left to fend for themselves.
If you're billing for a service and it's based on time, you keep looking at the clock, 15 minutes is up, you've delivered the service. Whether or not it has an outcome, you're not paid based on outcomes.
That's exactly right.
You're based
right.
on the service, and that's based on time. You're looking at the clock, 15 minutes is up, and then you submit the bill.
That's exactly right. And unfortunately, we did see so many agencies come and go.
So outcomes are important, and we'll talk about a farm that is delivering on outcomes, improving the outcomes. So tell us about now the farm at Penny Lane.
Yeah, so the farm at Penny Lane, one of the things that we have learned so far is people with serious mental illness die 25 years younger than someone without a mental illness. And a lot of it is because of poor health, physical health. So one of the reasons for us to start the farm at Penny Lane is to really start to look at people's health and wellness. What we are trying to do there is really grow our own food, teach people how to grow food, teach people how to eat healthy meals, especially when you're on a limited income. When somebody's SSI check is only $725, it is really hard to eat healthy by going to Whole Foods or Weaver Street Market. So this is a way of really teaching people how to learn, get back to the basics, get back to learning to grow your own food, and also eating healthy. So that was one of our missions for starting the farm at Penny Lane.
You are at this time an expert in mental health. Were you a farmer?
I was not.
So where did that expertise come from?
It's amazing how much Chatham County has as far as farming expertise. So we were able to put the word out. And it's amazing how many of our clients that we work with know about farming. Their parents have farmed. North Carolina is a farming community, and it's just sort of getting back to, for us and for the clients too, to the roots in some ways.
So what's a day in the life? What is it? You've got 40 acres.
Yeah, we have 40 acres. We're only using about an acre at this point. We have a lot of space left. We have lots of plants growing there. We have several smaller projects that we have started. We have shiitake mushrooms that is growing there. We have clients learning how to grow them. We have about 30,000 Russian bees. We are working on taking care of bees as well as producing honey. We are working on something called aquaponics. It is essentially growing tilapia in big fish tanks and growing plants on top of the fish tanks. So that,
yeah, because it turns out that fish waste is probably equally valuable, or as valuable, if not more, than the fish itself. Is that right?
That's right. The fish droppings are rich in nitrogen, and the water gets circulated back to the plants, and plants absorb the nitrogen, which they really need. So it's an amazing system that we have built up there.
Well, and is it a residential facility? Are folks living out there?
People are not living out there now, and we are hoping, as part of our phase two, we are working with our neighbor at the farm at Penny Lane, who is willing to sell the land, that we would like to purchase the land and think about maybe even putting a few supportive housing units out there.
How many people are working on the farm right now?
So we have an average of 15 to 20 people come on a regular basis, but we have various people coming at different times to be able to work. We are still in the beginning stages. Mm. We have a greenhouse that is going up right now. It's a big 50-foot greenhouse. We just yesterday brought 50 Australop chicken. So we have one of our clients who's very interested in sustainable poultry. So we should have free range eggs sometime in August.
Wow. What about the range of disabilities? Are you who's there?
Right. So we have people with severe and persistent mental illness like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and major depression. And we do have people who have developmental disabilities, people who have experienced addiction, people with physical disabilities. So it's a mixed range of people who come there. But we also have lots of volunteers. We have faith-based groups coming there. So when our folks are out there, we don't talk about their disability. It's a place where everybody is treated equally. You probably won't even know who is a client and who is someone who is a staff person works there.
Is there any kind of a training program that everybody goes through? You go to the farm, find out what you're interested in.
Right. So we are working with the North Carolina Botanical Gardens. They are getting ready to start a formalized horticulture therapy program out there for us now. So that'll be a big piece where our clients will be enrolled in that program.
What kind of research do we have on horticulture therapy? Do we know it works and how well?
We are actually going to be part of the research as we speak. We are working with our local management entity called Cardinal Innovations, which administers Medicaid, to start to collect data on complementary therapies and see if there is a way within a year we can have some good data and then use that data to be able to create a new Medicaid service definition that can pay for these services on the long run.
So right now it's not covered, and you're relying on nonprofits and the university.
That's exactly right. So the university and the Department of Psychiatry and some of our local funders are able to help us move this forward at this point.
So we're still waiting for the objective data, but anecdotally, what are you seeing?
It's amazing. I've had the woman yesterday who was holding onto the chicken, a little baby chicks, saying that I've got my life back. This is what I wanted to do.
I know you can't use names, and so we'll try to protect identities, but can you give us any sense of what are her disabilities? What's she dealing with?
Yeah, she was a very, very smart, educated woman with two master's degrees. Unfortunately, illness as well as homelessness because of the illness has touched her. But she is on a rebound. It's amazing how well she's doing now. So,
and generally, when people leave the farm, where are they going back? What's their setting?
So they are already living in their own homes, and the ACT teams and other clinical teams are supporting them. Here is a place moving beyond their symptoms and moving beyond being stable. This gives them a life in some ways to start to explore their potential.
Also, it seems to me in terms of sustainability, this offers some interesting possibilities because you can get to a point, I'm guessing, where you can start generating some income, right?
That's exactly right. So we are working on a special project right now with the state of North Carolina on supported employment. And part of that supported employment, it's called IPS supported employment, individual placement and supports. So part of the IPS supported employment is for us to now work on creating small micro enterprises or self-employment for people who want to do that type of work.
It's interesting, thinking back to your days in India in those refugee camps, micro-enterprise was what you were working on then.
That's right. It's just amazing how all of this comes in a round circle back again.
Tava, what a great pleasure talking with you. Tava Mahadevan, the founder of The Farm at Penny Lane and the director of operations for the Center for Excellence in Community Mental Health at UNC School of Medicine, also the executive director of the nonprofit XDS that provides health and wellness services to people with mental illness. Coming up next, a one-woman show about a drone pilot. Stay tuned.